that sort of effort in those four areas of life is a basic overall kind of structure. Then another way of talking about it, and again this is a little bit more abstract, but I think it's useful to mention, what we call the four right efforts, which is the effort to prevent unwholesome dhammas which have not yet arisen from arising, and then from those that have arisen, finding ways to reduce or alleviate them, finding ways of bringing into one's life the good qualities that have not yet arisen, and then caring for and cultivating those that have already arisen. You know, you look at your life and look at okay, now you may feel, I'm quite relaxed, I'm peaceful, I don't get angry very often, I'm not anxious or depressed, but then you say you don't have any right to spend the rest of your life free of those kinds of things, that you can't just take it for granted that you're never going to have to deal with really heavy kind of grief, anxiety, fear, paranoia, depression. So the question is, what kind of defenses have you got? What kind of vaccine have you got that you can say, I'm confident that, you know, if I was to, if something unfortunate was to happen, I've got the resources to be able to deal with it. It's not a matter of waiting till something bad happens and then it's like looking for a first aid kit or some kind of spiritual teaching that you can just sort of apply like a plaster or a quick fix to deal with it. So it's a matter of really using your intelligence and looking at particular areas where you do sense some weakness or some difficulty, and finding what teachings are going to be particularly applicable there. Now, say so much of it, of Buddhist teaching is, as you know, focused on the mind, but at the same time we can't separate that from the body. And with the and speech. Now, if you ever tried to meditate and your mind's complete mess, and you know you're just so upset about something, and you try to say, what exactly is the cause of that upset? How often it is it's something that someone has said or done, or that you've said and done that you feel bad about? So. Taking care on that side, making your actions and your speech impeccable. And what I mean by impeccable is that at the end of every day, you can review your behavior during that day, and you ask yourself the two things. You ask yourself, firstly, is there anything I've said or done the day that I could criticize myself for, which I feel unhappy about? Not to make yourself feel down or low, but really just to be looking very carefully at that. Or if you say, no, I think nothing. But you have to ask yourself a second question, which is there anything I've said and done today that if my spiritual teacher was aware of, that he might criticize or she might criticize me for? Because that's like the second, it's a more, it's not quite so easy to answer that one. Now, in many religious systems and philosophy, you have this idea of commandments, or that there is a god or a deity up there who's laid down certain rules that you've got to keep. And if you keep them, you'll be rewarded, and if you don't, you'll be punished. So it's kind of reward-punishment system, using fear and desire as the motivators. So that's the way that most moral systems work, using those kind of basic emotions. Whereas, because Buddhism is not a belief system, it's an education system. Idea of morality is not of commandments, reward, punishment. It's that you are educating your conduct. Okay. So when we take the precepts, Panatipata, Veerakmani, Sikkhapadang Samadhiyami. So Sikkhapadang Sikkhavot means bodh siksa. So it's a and sikha samadhiyami means making. I'm making this determination or this commitment to use the intention to refrain from hurting other beings as a tool to educate my conduct. This is what the precepts mean. It's very different from from believing and following a commandment. You say, I'm interested in educating the way I behave by using the certain kinds of intention as tools or as hooks for mindfulness, as something to develop my intention. So it's a purification of intention. So before you act, before you speak, you have to have an intention in your mind. So the way to develop this impeccability is awareness of intention. Now intentions are rising and passing away in your mind so quickly that it's so difficult to keep abreast of intentions. But if you have certain key intentions which you take on as precepts, then they're really right there in the front of your mind. They're always just in the front drawer of your mind, and they're popping up in your mind very easily. Then you have like a grid or to keep aware of the way where your mind is moving. So it's like, you know, if you're following a moving object on the screen, if it's divided into a grid like on a radar screen, it's that much easier to follow it. Oh, it's going from A1 to B3 or something like that. So you have certain kinds of intentions which are you've taken on as precepts. Now the five precepts are not the sort of the end of sila, but if your conduct is kept within the five precepts, what that means is you can be sure that you're not off track. That's a good measure. And if you are breaking any of the precepts, even though you have Dhamma teachings to support it, and this Zen master said this, and this Tibetan teacher said that, and this, you know, if you're breaking any of the five precepts, you can tell you're lying to yourself. Basically, you're deceiving yourself. So the Buddha was vichārcarana sampanno putang pramde vichāle carana, which means that vichā, which is like the knowledge inside, and jarana, the conduct, are harmonious, are one and the same. So that if there is pure vichā and understanding, right view, there's inner development, it will inevitably manifest in your conduct to others. And if you say, well, yeah, I've really got this together, I understand Buddhism, but yeah, I still do this and I still do that, that's you haven't understood yet, because that in itself is fong in a dua, you know, it's not right. So this, you know, sometimes talking about sila, you know, five precepts are presented, and you know, it's just if everyone keeps the five precepts, everything would be all right. Well, that's never going to happen. It's never happened in the past. It won't happen in the future, where you get everyone keeping five precepts. But to take it and to understand, you know, why the five precepts are useful in terms of your overall spiritual development, your overall sense of happiness, self-respect, and so on, is really important. And in any kind of community, from starting off with family, going to workplace, to village, town, city, you know, that the most important thing is trust. So this is a question: how do you create trust in a family between a husband and a wife? How do you create trust between parents and children? How do you create trust in the workplace? What single thing you say will create trust? A practical thing that you could say, yes, is something we can do, and it's precepts. No, you can, because it's not beyond people's capacity, even quite spiritually undeveloped people, to when they understand the value of it, to keep these precepts. So if you're married, for instance, you know, it's not suddenly, you know, you've got a husband or a wife, girlfriend, boyfriend, that you stop finding every other member of the opposite sex attractive anymore. You know, you still got this kind of desires, you still got the same kind of likes and dislikes. But, and you can't say, oh, I'm evil, I'm wrong, you know, I've got a girlfriend, I'm married, and I still find other people attractive. You know, that's wrong thought, because you're taking responsibility for things you can't take responsibility for. This is just natural from old karma and from old But the step where you can take responsibility for is you say, even though I do feel attracted to that person or that person, I'm not going to act upon it. I'm not going to speak. I'm not going to flirt. I'm not going to do anything as an expression of that kind of thought. So it stops there. Yeah, you can't. So then, when it stops at the mind and there's no physical or verbal expression, you're able to see the thought, the sense of liking, disliking, whatever it is, just as a mental state which arises and passes away according to causes and conditions. And you begin to say, yeah, it's not who I am. You know, sometimes you may be really really stressed out with something, or really you've had an argument or something, and then your mind goes in one direction. Then another day you're in a different mental state and your mind goes in another way. And it's not that every time you see the same thing that you have the same response. Like, okay, every time I see the color white, I see the color white almost, you know, the same every, as long as it's daylight, it's not dark, you know, there's sufficient light to see it, I see white. But my response to that, the mental states that arise, are going to change. And similarly, in your relations with other people, you still see them and you still hear their voice or whatever, but the kind of thoughts that and feelings that arise are varying all the time, arising and passing away. Now, when you have a clear-cut limits and boundaries for your behavior, then you're able to get a perspective on what's happening within. You have a sort of a clear path. You have standards for yourself. And being able to keep to those standards over a period of time gradually increases your self-confidence and self-respect. You know, after a while, you know, even if I was in such and such a situation and there was such and such a temptation, I know I can that I wouldn't follow that. And that's really a very important kind of foundation in your mind for spiritual practice. You know, you trust yourself, you have that kind of self-confidence. And that only comes through, as they say, setting boundaries for your conduct and being able to keep within them over a period of time. So this is why precepts are important. You know, it's not like, now I'm pure, I keep the five precepts, I'm special. And I think there's this wonderful teaching in the suttas that the Buddha gave, in the sutta called Sapurisa Sutta, the Satpurut. You know, the good person, and the good man, the good woman. He said, even if you keep precepts, and then you consider yourself superior to someone who doesn't keep precepts, you're a fool. You're not a satpurut. You know, even if you can meditate and you can be really peaceful and jhana and jnana, if on the basis of any spiritual attainment at all, you consider yourself superior to someone who doesn't have that attainment, then you've lost it. You're not practicing the Buddha's teachings. You're not wise. You're not a satpurut or a satsatri. Because that's the defilement. That's the important. That's mana. That's conceit. You see, and that making separation us and them. You know, I'm right. You're wrong. I'm white. You're black. I'm clever. I'm smart, you're stupid. This is one of the major causes of dukkha in our life, isn't it? Okay. So developing mindfulness, obviously, ability to be present to your experience. And if you look at your mind, I would suggest that 70-80%, probably 90% of what you think about every day is junk, that you don't really need to think about it at all. And that if you were to cut some of that junk out, you'd have a lot more time to be peaceful, and you'd also have a lot more time to think about worthwhile things and things that would be really lead to increased wisdom and happiness in your life. So, you know, it's not that with meditation you just want to be someone who doesn't ever think about anything, but you don't want to be a slave of thinking. If you are smart, intelligent, or you use your mind, you have to use your brain a lot in your work, or you've been successful academically, then tendency is to identify with thought a lot. And to consider that's who you are, that's your personality, that's what makes you special or different from other people, and that's who you really are. And so this is why people who've been educated, you know, in the conventional sense, a lot often find it more difficult to meditate than people who've had much less education. So most of the great arahants in Thailand, you know, sort of Jokbosi, sort of Bohok, you know. So, you know, once you've been educated beyond Bohok level, you're already in trouble as far as, you know, spiritual progress is, you know, it gets more and more difficult. I mean, not because, that's not to say that developing the intellect is wrong or foolish in any way, but that it is very easy, as I say, to identify with thought to the extent that they have this strong irrational fear of dwelling without thought, that the tendency to want to control everything becomes very strong. So these ideas of fear of lack of thought, absence of thought, I fear that somehow some part of you is going to disappear. Paranoia about it is a real obstacle. But to give, if that's a bit discouraging, when Western monks first started coming to Wat Pa Phong and living with Ajahn Chah, then he would say to them that it's more difficult for you to make your minds peaceful than many of the Thai monks who just from farm boys who've never, you know, had much formal education. But if and when you do make your mind peaceful, you'll have a lot nicer place to live in. It's like the many of the Thai monks, when they become peaceful, it's like they have a very little house. It's very easy to clean and keep clean, but then you just got a little house. You say, well, you've got like a big house. It takes a lot to keep clean, but once it is clean, it's a really nice house to live in. In other words, if you developed is the power of thought and investigation through in the course of your education, once you do make your mind peaceful and then apply that intelligence to Dhamma, for instance, then the wisdom faculty will be much in excess of someone who's become peaceful very quickly and has never had to develop much investigation of Dhamma.